Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Matt Dines of Build. Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Nick. Pleasure to be back here.
Today, we want to talk about China. We want to talk about Bitcoin institutions and financialization. But let's start with the big action from the PBOC. What did China do overnight? What was the market reaction?
Yep. So overnight, just to give a summary on the PBOC kind of liquidity and stimulus announcements. So we have what I'd call monetary policy classic for what we've seen in the modern central banking cycle with some typical rate cuts. And then we had, I think, a bigger one that I think will go down on the prints of something we may have not seen since, you know, the last couple of centuries look back window, and we'll get into that. So the big headline is your typical policy central banking levers. So they announced, you know, kind of a holistic package, right? You go to the Fed last meeting, you know, two Wednesdays ago at this point, we got a 50 bips cut to the Fed funds rate, no other real changes on monetary policy implementation notes. PBOC came out with a huge docket last night. So just to give the lineup of monetary policy classic kind of steps that were taken. So there was a 20 bips cut to the 7-day reverse repo facility rate. So that takes that rate from 1.7% down to 1.5%. They announced that there would be an incoming 50 bips cut to the PBOC's reserve requirement ratio for banks from 10% to 9.5%. There's going to be a 50 bips cut to rates on existing mortgages. So, you know, it's well familiar, you know, trotted ground or discussion topic on the Bitcoin Layer about the Chinese real estate market and kind of the deflationary bubble or, you know, bubble stage that market has been going through. So that'll reprice rates down, existing mortgages down 50 bips, kind of like a refi. That's very stimulatory. And then this one's also kind of an obvious liquidity injection. So the minimum down payment on second homes has been reduced from 25% to 15%. So these are all leverage inducing moves within the existing financial system itself. Just kind of a bazooka of monetary policy classic, I think, what we've seen since, you know, the last 3 to 4 decades in central banking actions. But I think the big kahuna, something we haven't seen for potentially many centuries from, or a couple of centuries from a large central bank, and we can update the tape. I know Twitter is going to be good. There's monetary policy historians who may update me, but we have a couple of comps for this that are really interesting case studies, which I think we can talk about. But the big kahuna that I think was the surprise to markets and participants was the announcement of this stock stability fund, which is going to allow institutional players, so non-banks, to tap central bank financing at a liquidity window with their stock holdings. So this is going to be set up as kind of swap facilities that will allow non-banks, so insurance companies, asset managers, broker-dealers, to post their security. So think equities here. You know, you see the Hang Seng chart. We can get into that and the massive drawdown, extremely cyclically low, we're talking decades long, low PE ratios, like bottom of a cycle type chart dynamics going on there. But these non-bank entities can now post their equity securities as collateral with central bank, like for these lending facilities. And it's functionally it's like floated that it's going to work as swaps. So they'll swap their equities at this liquidity facility for government bonds or sovereign debt. And then those government debts are then your highly liquid collateral within the CNY denominated financial system. Now you've swapped equities for highly liquid collateral. You don't have to sell. You can lever up in repo markets, borrow against, you know, sovereign debt, et cetera. And it's not too difficult to see this is going to be a very strong backdrop for introducing liquidity into this bubble system.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults where you hold 2 of 3 keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. This is a really important feature. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage with Unchained's trading desk and completely eliminate your exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry. You can convert easily your 401k or IRA into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Go talk to them today, unchained.com/TBL, and make sure you use code TBL for $99 off when you create an account. All right, Dines, I want to get into a little bit of the history for sure. I want to talk about the broker-dealer facility that will allow equities to be posted as collateral. I want to talk about Russell Napier's call from earlier this year that these levels of cyclically low PE ratios, historically low PE ratios, are usually conducive to shifts in the monetary system. So I want to discuss all those things. But before we get to that, let's talk about CNY. I know in your notes you have CNH, just to give the audience a background there. Dines and I will use CNY and CNH interchangeably. The reason we do so is because the Chinese yuan, CNY, is the currency of China and is fixed every day by the central bank. So it's the published rate. But the rate itself fluctuates throughout the day because the Chinese government, Chinese banking system has started to let that currency float. CNH is the offshore ticker. It's the Chinese yuan contract that trades out of Hong Kong, basically in these offshore markets. It is arbitrage toward CNY, but it gives us an indication of where the currency is going on an intraday basis, more so than CNY does. But over the long term, the charts will look the same. So with all that being said, what happened in CNH when the move happened? How have you thought about the Chinese yuan in the context of this? Because I'll just throw it out there that it was a little counterintuitive to me to see the bazooka and the currency strengthening.
Yeah.
You would usually expect the currency to weaken. So walk us through what's going on with the currency.
Yeah. So CNY versus CNH, just very quickly. We're used to, in the United States, thinking about the US dollar, the offshore dollar, the onshore dollar. We treat those as the exact same thing. We don't monitor, you know, Fedwire dollars differently than non-Fedwire dollars. Historically, that's been the case. There's some changes there going on with the SOFR market, everything like that. But in China, they've been very strict on setting up their internal, you know, banking capital, the CNY, who has access to that unit of account, versus offshore banks, which are allowed to transact in the offshore yuan, which has the ticker symbol CNH. And as Nick said, they should be close to 1-to-1. There shouldn't be much divergence over time. Otherwise, you're opening up arbitrage opportunities throughout the system. So eventually that gap has to close. But from time to time, those two things can diverge just based on the ebbs and flows of international capital markets. So for background here, if you all remember the weakening of the CNY kind of trend, you're looking on longer time frames versus the dollar. That's kind of reversed here since, I'd say, maybe July, August. So if you think about this dynamic, right, you've got an obvious setup where you've got a tailwind for the domestic Chinese equity market at this point. Like when you can post equities now as an internal, you know, broker dealer, go to the central bank and get back, you know, essentially borrow dollars, or not dollars, but like hard currency, sovereign CNY denominated government bonds. You can basically flip those and borrow in repo markets, turn them into hard currency. And so essentially what this does is this is a huge tailwind for equity prices. You no longer have to sell. So this is, in my view, from a portfolio manager standpoint, an immediate buy the news headline when you see that unexpected kind of window announcement come open. So inside the domestic Chinese economy, it's pretty obvious here. There's all these steps to reflate the real assets bubble situation, deflation dynamics in the say the real estate market, for example. But then you've also got the financial assets with stocks and bonds. And so now that you can post those as collateral at the central bank as well, this is just a huge tailwind. And we can go into the historical setup for how these situations play out with your comparisons. But so inside the domestic Chinese economy, what this kind of has the effect, it really shifts you towards keeping your capital parked inside of the Chinese economy, if you will, inside of Chinese assets. If everything's, you know, positive underlying dynamics, as opposed to the story we've heard for the last, you know, years slash decades of, you know, basically struggling lows, PE lows, real estate bubble, all of that. Rather than leaving now your you know, yuan denominated capital, you're probably going to buy your economic incentive now is to bid those assets. You want more of those because the price is going to go up. And that has an effect on stemming the flows of domestic capital that wants to leave for international safe havens. So it's very positive for the CNY, just based on slowing down those flows from domestic to external. But on the other side of that too, everybody now who in these globalized interconnected financial markets, like I read this, you know, on my, you know, Bloomberg Anywhere app last night, every portfolio manager in the US, you know, EU, et cetera, Australia, Japan, they all know this headline too. And, you know, smart people in these seats, they know what's going to happen to the Chinese equity markets. They know what this means. And, you know, if you've, you know, studied how you trade a bubble, for example, how you position for a bubble. And then I said, treat this as a buy the news event. But you look at the first step, George Soros says when he sees a bubble forming, he rushes in to buy, right? That's what you do. So for your international capital, if you have the ability within your kind of mandate of the funds you run or accounts you run, if you're permitted to go global, you need, like today, you have to consider relative to all your other weightings, all your other holdings, well, do I bid these Chinese equities? And maybe that comes in the form of ADRs within a specific market. So we'll talk about that. But all else equal, you know, as a portfolio manager outside of China, you've got to decide amongst, you know, let's say you're an emerging markets equity holding or, you know, cross-currency bond portfolio manager, whatever. You have to, you know, play this as well. So you obviously have a bubble forming, like if you just stack rank all of your other kind of asset classes you can go into or sovereigns you can deploy into. So you're saying, okay, do I want to play in this bubble as well, that the domestic Chinese economy and their internal capital is going to also pump? So immediately, like, what would you look for in those signals there to see that are the international flows coming in? Because you've got some other massive headwinds about the China narrative and story right now, if you're international. And this goes down to just some one-on-one discussions I've had with institutional allocators inside the United States. You've got state-level pensions, for example, who are facing mandates from their like their boards, their, you know, higher ups, their government officials that they respond to divest from Chinese equities and, you know, Chinese financial asset markets. So you've got some obvious kind of headwinds that will clamp down the flows of international equity or international capital into China and this bubble dynamic. But there's still a lot that's freed up. So private capital and then those headwinds, it may be just one-offs, right? It may be state by state level who's guiding their pensions or directing their pensions or individual boards or investment committees guiding that behavior. But some obviously are going to make it in. They're going to see that bubble opportunity, even though you've got all these headwinds with China. We can get into that situation developing in the South China Sea. The Philippines situation is the hot button issue that's not getting enough media attention and financial coverage, in my opinion. But you see, all those headwinds aside, someone's still going to do it and flow capital in to chase this opportunity. So what you would watch for is, in my opinion, the offshore yuan, because that's where your international money center banks can transact through Hong Kong and move dollars or euro potentially into CNH, and then that can be deployed into your Chinese domestic equity markets or real estate, what have you. And it will also materialize, I think, in your ADR. So your large cap Chinese listed ADR, so Alibaba, JD.com, Baidu, NetEase. Those are your examples of your largest cap. And so if you look at the intraday or overnight performance of those equities since the announcements, and you comp them to kind of where the domestic Hang Seng closed yesterday, you kind of get a signal that there is at least somewhat of a rush in response to this buy the news from international capital. So just to mark to market here, JD.com had a massive overnight rally, plus 15%, Alibaba plus 8%, NetEase plus 8%, Baidu plus 7%. So this is domestic, you know, US-based capital that's bidding these ADRs, which ultimately has to work its way through to own those equities in the Chinese system.
Makes a lot of sense. So, yeah. And so in summary, what we have is a rate cut, which should not support the currency. Mm-hmm. But on net, we have the currency strengthening because of the expected inflow of capital or the physical inflow of capital. Yep. To buy the assets themselves because of the stimulative action.
Yep. And this is a different dynamic than we've seen from most other, I'd say, both DM and EM currencies over the last, at least since post-2020 environments, where you've seen a lot of the key DM currencies, so US dollar, euro, JPY, et cetera, start to be more penalized every time they cut rates or ease or strengthen when they hike. China cuts, you get the bubble dynamic, and they strengthen today. So it is a divergence from what we've seen from the, chalkboard on the other, I'd say, big, the major sovereign nations in today's macro landscape.
And the price is obviously always going to tell us the story. And last week, we saw Chinese yuan strengthening. So something was up. Somebody knew. And when I saw the news overnight, it clicked that this was in reaction to that. But it wasn't until you fully verbalized it that really I am understanding that this is a buy the news event, but it's a buy the currency to buy the assets event.
And for some, doesn't have to be for every. And there's other outlets you can play this, and we can get into those.
And real quickly, Dines, on gold. We see gold that has reacted very well all year long. The breakout happened a few months ago. I think we're in essentially no man's land until you get to 3,000. Gold is looking very, very strong. No man's land in that you're above the breakout, so you're in all-time high zone. So there is no technical resistance. And the only technical resistance there are your projected waves, right? Your projected or your extended trends and those types of things. So, you know, we have it at, call it 1,200 to 2,000 as the consolidation range over the course of several years. And the breakout adding 800 onto that 2,000 to 2,200 puts us at 3 grand. But what are you seeing from gold from the overnight session over the last week, and put in the backdrop of what's going on with the rest of the global economy?
Yeah, so gold isn't on a separate, you know, plane than what's going on, everything we've been discussing with international capital. It is your outlet. Like what you see going on with the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and I'm not the expert on market micro infrastructure here. You can have, you know, someone else come on, but I do know enough to be dangerous here. You've got a physically settled gold contract now that's originated. I think it launched 2013, 2014. It was actually the PBOC who floated the body in 2002 to start setting this up. So they got this underway, like right at the bottom of that gold print in that consolidation range you were talking about, Nick. And that market's been building up steam now for 10, 12 years. So I think the migration of gold flows, central bank buying, all of that, that is a massive part of this story. I think we'll get into, you know, some of the centuries long history here to see the historical context and how I'm understanding the backdrop. But gold has been bid all year, despite whether you look at, you know, one central bank pulling back or when, you know, when is the Russian central bank buying, when is India buying, when is China buying. Gold has been pretty much relentless this year. Just, you know, one, we saw that consolidation. We saw, you know, that 2000 level breach for a bit in, I want to say July, August 2020, like in that COVID stimulus pump from the U.S. domestic response. But you went through 3 years of consolidation, or it felt like, you know, you couldn't take out that 2000 level. You couldn't get the weekly close, monthly close, quarterly close, et cetera, above 2000. And this year, like once it did it, I think it was actually December close. Just correct me if I'm wrong here in post, but I think it was the December close this year that it finally closed above 2000. And then it's just been a relentless bull run here. So what you're seeing here is these cross-border transactions. You've got the gold physically settled in Shanghai. You've got all these arbitrage opportunities now moving gold, you know, taking physical delivery from, you know, one jurisdiction to the other. So everything you're seeing in futures markets is kind of playing out in that cross-border arbitrage where private capital is going to just relentlessly earn those arbitrage returns. They're going to move the gold if they can get it at a higher price, make dollar currency gains by taking gold, giving physical delivery in Shanghai. That's going to play out. So all of this is a net effect of the gold futures markets. But then that's also a dynamic with the interest rate markets on sovereign bonds, because, you know, you've got dynamics where futures markets, they price technically that interest rate on your sovereign debt as part of your, it's your main input, as well as, you know, the spot price of your underlying and then the cost of carry to determining, you know, what today's futures price will be. You've got the producers and their costs also as a huge element of that. But then where the futures markets and then the sovereign interest rates, you know, are trading government debt, all of these things, you know, if one market's out of line, there's an arbitrage there. Someone's going to create like a three-legged trade, clear some risk-free dollars, ship the gold, or, you know, gold is a commodity where you've got a pretty massive market, deeply liquid. You can, you know, big flows can happen there. And so this dynamic of the gold price in the last, let's say, 9 to 12 months, it's really been since November 22, where the local bottom of the chart, you know, ticked. It was the same time in Bitcoin and, you know, I guess we'll say the broader crypto economy, which I don't care about them. It's all Bitcoin in my book. But it was the FTX collapse that ticked the bottom, like gold bottom ticks right there in October 2022. I mean, pretty much right alongside every other risk asset. So this dynamic you're seeing, this massive bull market or the bull wave in gold, is part of that underlying story. It's like you've got the arbitrage here for physical delivery, and it's coming down to where is the gold stock going to reside? Same thing if you put it in the world of the Bitcoin, which sovereign jurisdiction, which businesses, which individuals hold X share of the 21 million UTXOs, who holds the keys for those ledger units. It's kind of the same thing in gold. Who actually has the gold? And we're getting price discovery across these sovereign currencies, these units of account, as, you know, that process works through. And then the translational medium is your futures markets and your sovereign debt rates levels. And then also FX is a play in there.
And it's not a coincidence that also bond volatility peaked at around that same time. And it's in our study now, Dines, as you know, to think about liquidity, global liquidity in the context of what is going on with the MOVE index, because with more and more uncertainty on the path of interest rates, you have a less ability for banks to create money through collateralization. And with falling interest rates, but not just falling interest rates, more certainty on the path of interest rates, it will decline, that will reduce bond volatility and will be supportive to risk assets. So I think broadly you see that impacting everything from gold to stocks to Bitcoin since late 2022. Let's talk about the historical context now for central banks getting involved in stoking stock markets. Give us a quick summary. What is the most important thing people need to know from the historical context? And I know you've done a lot of work here, but boil it down for people. What do they need to take away from this type of action and where we've seen historical precedents?
Yep. So last night, you know, this was the hot item, hot topic on FinTwit or Bitcoin Twitter. And one of the replies I got was, wow, has this ever happened before? We tend to think in decades, you know, back maybe like 30, 40 years in our lifetimes. Hey, has a central bank ever allowed equities to be pledged as collateral? Like, that's really going beyond the mandate of lender of last resorts to your banking system within a sovereign, right? Sounds like a massive step. We're actually not setting new ground, right? This has kind of been tried before. And the immediate case studies that came to mind were actually at the turn of the 1700s would be the turn of the 18th century, right? If I have that right. So roughly 1690 to let's say 1720, you saw some monetary experimentation in both England and France. And I think they make a good compare and contrast to play off each other to directly kind of think about what's going on between the China situation monetarily and the United States today. So I think John Law is the one to start with. This is the easy one. John Law was an interesting kind of, I think he was a Scottish economist, crossed the English Channel, made some friends and contacts in high society in France, and ultimately got the Bourbon king, so Louis the 15th, to treat his Bank Royale as the not quite the central bank of France, but the quasi central bank of the day, which basically handled the government's financial affairs, raised the crown's credit capital. So what John Law did was kind of an interesting experiment in monetary history. I guess you could say he was ahead of his time. So there was the Mississippi Company, which was kind of like carved out of the territories that became, you know, 100 years later, the Louisiana Purchase. But this was basically a company that held a charter to conduct all trading at the Port of New Orleans, basically economically transact in this mercantilist model that dominated this era. Kind of the goods and agriculture outputs, the commodities that were coming out of the kind of the American interior. So everything except for pretty much the Northeast. If you can drain it, flow it through the South, get it into the Port of New Orleans. It's not hard to see that this was obviously an economically valuable thing. But what he actually did was he took that joint stock company, the Mississippi Company, and he just cranked up a monetary bubble on top of this thing. So this was all done in the names of financing kind of the sovereign crown and their public debt situation or their financing situation that was in tough straits after basically a century of war in the 1600s on the European continent and between England and pretty much everybody. So what you are allowed to do at this Bank Royale as a Mississippi Company shareholder is you just treat these shares as your repo lending kind of security of choice, and you tap that for bank financing. Now, what you're doing there is you're creating a speculative bubble, and ultimately those loans, like when you borrow against an asset, you're signing up for debt service. And in the bubble dynamic, when you create more and more debt, you're actually ramping up the debt service that's owed, and that debt service has to be paid out of your economic, your currency flows. So all of the economy coming, like economic activity coming out of the Mississippi Company, which is basically just condensed down to that Port of New Orleans, which is, a massive growth market. Don't get me wrong. Like it was a great thing, right? Highly valuable economic asset, but the productivity couldn't keep up with the amount of credit claims that had been created in the, Paris-based financial system. And so that thing just spectacularly collapsed. And this is all within a space of 5 years or, very short time frame on how this played out. So from that approach, from a sovereign monetary perspective, financing the, the public debt situation, it shows that this is, if you just do that alone and you kind of stoke a speculative bubble in financial assets, yes, you can tax them. Yes, you can tax your economic activity going through international trade like they did in the Port of New Orleans. But the market will eventually get ahead of itself. It's very hard to restrain the lending. What he did was he just kept cutting the collateralization rates on your essentially your margin loans on this security. You just built up a bubble until it got too big to keep going, and spectacularly busts. So we know that's a road to nowhere, right? As a monetary policy solution, no central banker should be doing that in isolation. Stoking speculative bubbles. You can go into a lot of financial academic research on this. Is that good monetary policy? I would argue probably not, but they will, like all central banks have done this, whether they'll admit it or not, as part of the policy framework. Now we juxtapose that with the situation in England, right? Which is, it goes through a similar situation in this time frame. You had the English Navy, right? Right now there was no United Kingdom in the 1690 to like 1710 landscape. The UK actually formed during this time frame, which I think is a key signal on the economic history, or the prince, right? This happens in this time window for a reason. But you had the Royal Navy, right? I forget who the king was at this time. I'm not, the deep expert on European history, and I take a US-based education to this. So they're secondary in my framework to the American narrative. But you had kind of a massive English Navy loss and a terrible credit position facing the crown. I think it was the House of Stuart at the time. These are just, the highest up of upper level society. You get to hold the crown, right? And so they had a really difficult public debt situation coming in at the end of the 1690s. And so there were, rather than just putting all your eggs in one basket, they actually tried the approach, the strategic path of putting a lot of irons in the fire, right? And one of those, the most important one we'll get to later, but one of those was the direct analog of the Mississippi Company. It was the South Sea Company, which the actual underlying economic asset was actually the slave trade, if you look into this. And it was supposed to be doing if you looked at the prospectus at the time, or what we think of today as a prospectus, why this company or startup would exist, it was going to engage in commodities trade, primarily slaves, with like South American markets, Africa, the colonies, basically. It really never got off the ground, but the speculative frenzy did. So the same time the Mississippi bubble was pumping in France, you had the South Sea bubble pumping in England. And this was actually one of the routes, same thing, post the South Sea bubble or South Sea Company shares as collateral to like within the City of London, within the banking system. Get pounds, buy more shares, whatever. Mm-hmm. Just a massive bubble was created in this entity. It also collapsed like financially. However, the South Sea Company did go on for a number of years, but this bubble sucked in like high society, like a lot of important people on the historical tape lost money. It ruined Isaac Newton, for example. So like this was a huge monetary event. It ultimately wasn't the answer on how the English government built itself up, kind of rebuilt its financial position after kind of the disasters of the 1600s, like just a lot of war and drain on the public purse. So when I said there were a lot of irons in the fire, I'll get through one more that didn't work. They tried to start a land bank as well. We don't need to cover that and go deep on there. But the one that did work and outcompete and came out as kind of the Darwinian survival of the fittest was actually what has become the Bank of England, right? So the Bank of England was started. It was floated in the 1690s by, I think it was an MP. I don't know. I'll get checked here. Was he House of Lords, House of Commons? But anyway, it was floated in the parliamentary bodies. That we should have a private institution that would fund the public credit situation. So we'd pool private capital, fund this build out, which was going to rebuild the Royal Navy, right? And you kind of see this playing along, and I'll juxtapose this with what we're seeing right now in China. But you see this get underway. It's enacted in the 1690s. You have all kinds of, just historical figures buying shares in this entity. And ultimately, like, this bank is not, it's very limited in what it can do. It can deal, it can be basically like a modern day broker dealer in government debt securities and bills of exchange. And then it can also deal in gold and silver bullion, right? So those, you know, that market framework where they're allowed to do business, this private bank, ultimately kind of reveals itself to be the winning capitalization framework, or capitalization strategy for sovereign currency. And you see this Bank of England, through having the gold bullion reserve and then also the bills reserve, or like the bills, and then financing the government debt, it becomes your, you know, de facto central bank, not by decree or not by fiat. It was an act of parliament that created it, but it doesn't emerge by kind of force of the crown. It emerges because of its own credit worthiness, because it's got the gold bullion reserve that no one else was doing, in my opinion. So you see the juxtaposition here, even though, you know, England went through the same South Sea bubble, you know, that collapsed. It didn't come out of that with the same struggles that we saw, you know, the French public purse go through, because it had kind of a let's try everything approach and was very permissive and ultimately found the winning strategy, right? And if you're looking at this today, I think the immediate reaction, you know, post PBOC's announcements yesterday evening, I don't think many of us saw the, what do they call it, the stock stability fund coming. That was the big surprise. Everybody knows, you know, cut reserve requirement ratio, cut repo rates, all of that. We know that's central bank, you know, standard procedure for the last four decades at minimum. But the stock stability fund, that type of approach, taking that John Law methodology to central banking, that was new. You also juxtapose it here and you see the commonalities that China is showing strategically that make it look more like the British situation from my perspective than the French situation. So two things there. It's pretty clear that China is focused on its naval buildup. You see the cost to build a naval vessel. There's individuals you can track on X and Twitter who know way more about this than I do. But it's very clear and obvious from my seat that China has a massive competitive advantage on cost to build new naval vessels, right? And you're seeing this play out right now in what's going on in the South China Sea, right? This conflict that's gradually been building up steam for over a decade now, where China is challenging its neighbors within the is it seven dashes line? I think they just made it eight dashes, right? To stretch it a little further. But basically, you've got the Chinese Navy now inflicting its will, basically imposing its will on you know, these shoals, South Thomas Shoal, Sabina Shoal, grounded trading vessel, the BRP Sierra Madre, that's sitting there as kind of a Philippines pseudo fort, basically laying claim to this Sabina Shoal, which a lot of these incidents are taking place like 100 miles off the coast of the Philippines. So from an international perspective, it's pretty clear that these would be international waters, or, you know, at best under, you know, Philippines kind of jurisdiction. But we're at a point, I think, in history where, you know, you're following the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules type of situation. And force is unfortunately what talks. So if you look at the monetary setup, what China's doing with the Shanghai Gold Exchange, you see this massive run up in gold as the fiat base, like unsecured debt and currency markets, those are being marked to market and repriced is what I believe we're living through or operating through, like in real time. I believe at this point, probably a strategic mistake to write off China as just a failing deflationary bubble. There's too many. It is definitely that. There is that dynamic. They do need to stoke the financial asset, stock and bond market, same way the South Sea bubble and Mississippi Company were. But they've also got, in my opinion, once you zoom out and look at the picture from the 35,000 foot view, they've got a very clear strategic framework that they're executing against. And this is where we can get into Bitcoin and the US, and, you know, how do Western economies respond to this? That's where you get really underneath the surface. Some of the headlines, Nick, that you talked about discussing in pre here that we can get into with Bitcoin adoption of institutional capital markets in US, which I believe makes sense as the or an orthogonal response, which would be another English like playbook from the English setup in this key period of 1690 to roughly 1720, where you take a let's test many things strategic approach and not just bet everything on you know, one horse.
So I didn't expect us to go the route of talking about the Chinese Navy, but since you took it that way, let me just ask you, is this financial warfare, what China is doing in some way? I mean, if the way that you're describing the actions of the Chinese is in part to for the naval buildup, then is this act to attract capital actually a type of financial warfare that we're seeing?
So I think if you're looking at your own financial system, I think we have to define what financial warfare is. But we can't just limit war to, you know, one physical battlefield where we're thinking kinetic war is warfare. You know, there's information warfare. You know, we're seeing, you know, Chinese influence on, let's say, US-based social media through, let's say, TikTok. That's a story that's been well covered. But you, my point here is you do have, you know, what we say, like, I don't know if war might be the right word because we think of war as, you know, boots on the ground, but it is kind of engagement in conflict on an economic front. And I think, you know, your capital markets are your marking to market of that. So all of these strategic decisions, you know, how it flows through to foreign exchange markets, sovereign debt markets. And then I'd say the other key parameter you'd want to watch as a sovereign would be like the strength of your domestic financial system. Yeah, those are the like the key battlefronts in this kind of nation state framework that's really emerged since not to get too down the rabbit hole of history, but since like the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, where we really set the groundwork for modern day international relations, where these things we call nation states interact with each other. Point is, on this long stretch, like it's what we're almost 380 years past that Peace of Westphalia, where this whole thing has been in motion. Your banking system is that non-aggressive channel where the economics can play out, and your marketing to market. Ideally, you don't want this to go into, you said financial warfare, you don't want to go into actual kinetic warfare, because that's extremely destructive to societies, nation states. You say it's winner take all, right? But it's worse than that. It's negative sum, right? You might have a winner, but in all, you know, you just destroy a bunch of capital, eliminate, like just waste a lot of human lives. It's a negative. It's a net negative for everybody. But if you have to go that route, like go down to the mats, I mean, nation states have shown, like through various epochs, they will do that if they let things get out of line. You kind of have to hope that these situations of conflict, which I think we're clearly in right now, you see hotlines, you know, stretching all across any border with the Eurasian continent. So you start with kind of the old Warsaw Pact countries up, you know, Poland, Lithuania, like they're on hot button alert, especially since, you know, the mid 2010s, going down to the hot conflict in Ukraine, Russia border, down to, you look at Syria, like Middle East, a lot of situations in just open dispute. You stretch that battlefront to Israel with not just Hamas and internally with Gaza, but also now Lebanon kind of creeping up. And then you just keep going down that line to, let's say, Pakistan, You know, India looks very stable right now, but you've also got border conflict between India and China. You've got Sri Lanka in an interesting situation where U.S. dollar capital markets versus other international currencies are fighting for who's going to capitalize that that sovereign. So you see this kind of conflict, like you've got a very clear line of demarcation, like a line of scrimmage, if you will, to put this in football terms. And you just hope it doesn't spring out into kinetic conflict. And so that financial channel, yeah, this has been going on and escalating. I believe like the tape started with the Southeast Asian financial crisis in the 90s, and it just, you know, progresses through there. But this is kind of our modern history we're living through. So to put that in context, I think these headlines are very important.
Absolutely. And we didn't know that you were such a historian, Dine. So people will want to follow your analysis. And I know that you're following it as a financial analyst. And, you know, that's the angle I follow history through as well. But I want people to check your information out before we get to a couple Bitcoin topics, because we're almost out of time today. But did you change your Twitter handle? What did you change it to? It gives me a smile, so I obviously already saw it.
That's awesome.
But tell us what you did and why you did it.
Yeah, so I woke up Monday morning eager to get into the office, turn on my Bloomberg terminal, and do the work on these topics that I love. And so I don't know what it was, just that morning, everything clicking with me. It's like, well, it comes down to like from the Western framework right now, we look at SOFR, everything that's building out, with the sovereign debt situation, it's like levered treasuries. Like that's what we're putting in treasuries as our backstop. That's supposed to be our hard money, which is really just unsecured lending on a public deficit situation that is starting to look like that same precarious state that, you know, sovereigns get into. You know, that English and France example, 1690 to 1720, kind of in historical context, history rhyming, not necessarily repeating. So I just put it in. It's like, so for what is it? It's levered USTs. And then I'm like, oh, clever Twitter handles. It's like, what if I did something a little more, not just here's my name, here's my work, but also just like reflects the fun and kind of passion that I bring to this space and everything going on. And that's inclusive of Bitcoin as well, which I think, Nick, you and I are both share a strong degree of passion for and conviction and its play out in this emerging process. But just a little fun in the Twitter handle rather than just defining myself and thinking about my work as just a job. I think, you know, just putting a little bit of fun into it as opposed to just name and role. So I did, just because I know that, and Nick, you probably have this problem as well, Twitter bots creating fictional Twitter accounts, reaching out, trying to get people to send them money. I have that old handle earmarked. It's Build CIO. Parked it on another internal Build account, just so no bot could take that real estate and, you know, potentially defraud some of my friends and followers, et cetera, who, you know, go to people like me, Nick, et cetera, for opinions and perspective and color on what's going on in markets. But I don't know, just for now, I think levered USTs, it was available shockingly. You've got a lot of funny ones. I know yours is time value of BTC. I think it's kind of that same framework, just thinking about these things in that financial markets context.
We love it. It's a very layered money, the Bitcoin layer type of handle. So we encourage it.
I'm going to go with the
few minutes that we have left. Let's go really rapid fire on a couple of the big topics in Bitcoin. Why don't you talk about Bank of New York, the SAB 121 variants. Let's talk about BlackRock and Coinbase. What went down recently this week with the ETF custodian. And then finally, if you can just give us your quick opinion on IBIT options going live and furthermore increasing the financialization of Bitcoin.
Yeah, let's save the BNY for last. Let's go with the BlackRock Coinbase situation first. So, you know, the big headline this year captured the most attention for Bitcoin and financial markets has been the launch of these spot Bitcoin ETFs. I think it was 9 out of the 11. I can be double checked on that, but maybe 8 or 9 out of 11 are actually physically custodying the UTXOs with Coinbase. This comes at like a lot of the largest institutional Bitcoin holders. I believe MicroStrategy is among those 8 or 9 ETFs who are basically entrusting Coinbase with key management, key ownership of their Bitcoin ETFs. So if you think about it, all of these UTXOs, essentially, if you don't hold the keys, like you're actually holding a, you know, a credit relationship or, you know, a third party custody relationship with your Bitcoin. So the market dynamics and the function of, you know, inflows from just brokerage accounts where, you know, you log into your Fidelity, Schwab, Robinhood, et cetera. You buy a Bitcoin backed ETF, you know, ticker like IBIT, FBTC, et cetera. Once you press that buy, your trade is settled. What actually happens? Your kind of USD balance gets kind of sent over to your market maker, is actually who the broker dealer is facing on that transaction. And then your market makers on your ETF kind of aggregate and do the create redeems with the authorized participants. So your authorized participants for these big spot Bitcoin ETFs will be, you know, your large Wall Street kind of institutional names everybody's familiar with, like JPM, Goldman, et cetera. And they're allowed to actually do the kind of down to the metal, I would call it, like open up, look under the hood. They're the only entities, is why they're called authorized participants, who can actually do the share buys and sells increase share count, decrease share count in exchange for those spot UTXOs, right? So the question BlackRock has, because it doesn't operate like the ETF advisor doesn't operate typically as the authorized participant on its own shares. I'm not 100% certain that there couldn't be edge cases where that happens, but I think for conflict of interest, like SEC, NYSE probably wouldn't want to see that, just because, you know, maybe there's too much trust there amongst related parties. But typically what you're worried about, if you're the advisor, you want to make sure your share count represents the appropriate amount of, in this case, UTXOs backstopping each share, right? If you don't, you eventually run into a divergence in the accounting between the actual ownership of the assets and the kind of the shares or IOUs that you have pledged as claim as those assets. So if you're the advisor, if you're BlackRock, you're extremely worried about fractional reserving of your share count against that asset base. And in general, you would have good trust between your counterparties, right? Your third party administrators, all of that, everybody you trust to operate this ETF beyond just the RIA or basically the portfolio management capacity. In this case, it's these spot Bitcoin ETFs. It's very easy. You get inflows or outflows, you buy or sell Bitcoin. Like, not that hard, not many capital allocation decisions. So your key risk you really want to address is that trust and all those intermediate steps that go from the share count going up and down with the authorized participant create redeems, and then the actual UTXOs and the balances that are kind of written for benefit of your ETF trust. So the fact that BlackRock has kind of raised, and it's gone public now, it's part of public information, it's not just internal on talking to Coinbase, et cetera. You know, maybe there's not necessarily friction there. It could be one of two things. There actually is friction between Coinbase and BlackRock, and they're maybe taking a closer look at all of these settlements, and they actually want to see those UTXOs final settled in the name of the BlackRock Bitcoin ETF Trust on a shorter time horizon. Or they want to reinforce with the public, the retail buyers, that those UTXOs are in fact there. There's not, you know, an accounting divergence building up. There's not fractional reserving, et cetera. So that's what I would take from those. It's a very early signal of anything in particular in the spot Bitcoin ETFs, you know, potential issues, et cetera. But it is there, and it's something If you're a financial advisor, you're recommending these to your clients, et cetera, you want to be on top of it and aware. So I know this is like a down to the studs type of discussion, but I don't know. My take on this is if you're a financial advisor, you don't need to change anything you've been doing right now, but you should be taking this seriously, researching on. And, you know, if you weren't fully up to date on Bitcoin itself, how the protocol and the network works, how custody works, you should probably dive deeper in that. And then you should also dive deeper on how ETFs actually work. Because, you know, financial advisors are using ETFs, you know, predominantly, and it's grown kind of massively in market penetration. So these are two trends that are very important from the kind of financial advisory landscape. So it's just kind of a good, not a canary in the coal mine type of headline at all, in my opinion, but it's just a good, you know, look in the mirror and dive deeper if you're doing due diligence in this space. The other one was the
IBIT options, and you know, my take real quick here is that the increase of financialization for Bitcoin products has been with us since 2017 CME futures. We've had options on futures on the CME for a long time. So yes, this is a big deal, but we've had a lot of instruments already. So I'm curious if your opinion is much different than that.
Yeah. So I think in context, I need to update the figures here. CME Bitcoin futures volume is relatively low. It's been growing very well since they launched in December 2018. But there's not that much in terms of, you know, notional volumes or contracts traded. And it's all condensed into the front end. So the first contract, second contract. That means like settlement dates 1 month out, 2 months out. Technically, they're listed, I want to say up to like 3 to 5 years, but just no activity is there. So the options on the futures, you're posting options on kind of an illiquid market anyway. And those futures are really going to be used maybe a little bit by speculators. Like you want to lever up, you know, hey, I have my collateral, I'll post it here, put 10% down, you know, whatever the CME schedule tells me on the collateral I want to post. And you can take a levered price bet on Bitcoin. That may be happening with hedge funds, you know, some private players, but it's not really that big in the grand scheme of things yet. Now it's growing, and it's going to be really important here as those trends continue. Remember, we talked earlier about everything in China right now and how important futures are to everything going on there in price discovery. But options on futures, it's a much smaller market than what I think the Bitcoin ETFs have already become. So I haven't checked the market caps of these Bitcoin ETFs collectively, 10, 11, that have gained meaningful market share. But we're talking the best ETF launch, you know, in a window in history, in the 30-year history of the ETF industry. So these options on these ETFs will actually be tapping into a much bigger market for the underlying. And then you're going to apply that leverage to the underlying. And it's a different crowd, like a more speculative trader, I think. The ETF adoption has so far been primarily a retail phenomenon, is my understanding of what we've seen in 2024. So now we're going to tap and put the options market on top of that. From an infrastructure standpoint, what you're doing is you're connecting the market makers, right? Your options are going to flow through the CBOE, not the CME, where the futures and the options on the futures live. Now you're bringing in the CBOE market makers into the leveraged, you know, trading on top of the underlying ETFs. So now you've got two of those channels set up. This is just part of the broader integration into, I mean, just fiat and the financial asset bubble, but this will have a large effect, in my opinion, because if you think about it down to the studs, what do you do if you're a market maker? You just want to make a, you just want activity. You just want open interest and volume on these IBIT options chain. And so what do you do as that volume builds up? You're going to hedge yourself, whether it's, you know, calls or puts will tell you if you have to buy or sell to hedge your exposure. But you're, in this case, there's going to be, you know, delta and gamma effects working through the share count, like the actual market and the underlying. which is now because the underlying are kind of tethered. You've got the financial infrastructure linkage down to the UTXOs, because we talked about BlackRock and Coinbase, kind of the, let's call it friendly friction going on there. You've got an anchor now that goes down to the studs into the actual ownership on chain. You did not have that in the CME futures and the options on futures. So this is just a new financial channel that did not exist before, in my opinion, which is why you didn't see these derivatives kind of just opened up immediately after the spot Bitcoin ETF launches. Like, eventually they were going to happen, but they just wanted to wait a little bit to see how things played out.
Very interesting analogy about sinking into the studs here with the new options markets on top of Bitcoin and actually getting into the linkage to the UTXOs. Lastly, Dianne, talk about the variance for Bank of New York allowed to custody Bitcoin now. Give us your quick thoughts there.
Yeah, so technically you can see the headlines, like the press release is showing up on Business Wire. BNY actually released or opened up its digital assets custody kind of offering in 2022. It just didn't have kind of regulatory clarity or blessing to actually custody on behalf of institutional clients. When I say custody, just Bitcoin. Bitcoin's all that matters here. We don't care about your other digital assets, your other cryptos. So just think about what that step represents. Like, there's a whole dynamic you can go down in terms of Custodia Bank, Caitlin Long, you know, this choke point 2.0 discussion where you're not on a level playing field. And there's a rich discussion there in terms of domestic banking policy in the United States and an open playing field and how we want to, you know, as a sovereign or a domestic society approach this emerging asset class. In my opinion, taking a centralized approach is granting, we call it variance exceptions to the largest custody banks. Like, you're seeing the kind of the Jeffersonian versus Hamiltonian dialogue kind of repeat itself, I think, in this example. And I would say I'd lean more in the Jeffersonian camp myself there. We can dive deeper on that later, maybe on another episode.
Man, another deep cut history with the going all the way back to the Federalist Papers. But I'll let you finish, Dianne. Go ahead.
But if you look at what Bank of New York represents, right, it's one of the largest institutional custody banks in the global financial system. So last checkpoint, like, the number I have that they publicly disclosed was $48 trillion in asset custody. Which, if you think about this thing in the grand scale of financial assets, that's a massive piece of the overall denominator. So to kind of whitelist with the King's Charter, if you will, or the King's Decree here that came out over the last few days at this Senate committee kind of meeting, with Elizabeth Warren, Gary Lee Gensler, et cetera, present, and kind of grant a favored exception that deviates from modus operandi type of going concern policy from the SEC. I think that's an interesting thing that we should, I mean, we're having an election here in 2 months to decide how, what the policy landscape and what we want to do as a society for the next 4 years kind of looks like. On top of that, a longer term trajectory. But this is something that's probably buried below the headlines that needs to be bubbled up to the top of the discussion, at least in the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. So if there's one thing I can advocate on that front, it's to speak to my peer groups here. If you are listening, let's have that discussion here and now. What we want the U.S. banking system to look like. Now, I'll juxtapose that. So the fact that you see this print that BNY will now be able to custody Bitcoin on behalf of clients, right? That starts to look a lot like this private bank, Bank of England charter model, where you create an entity to fund the sovereign government. You can deal in gold and silver bullion. And eventually the gold bullion is the model that wins out because it has the strongest backstop or base money for a reserve currency. Like, if you want to learn more about this, There's a good book you should check out called Layered Money by a guy named Nick Bhatia. That'll dive you deep down that rabbit hole and give you a good perspective on that. But I think we're kind of rhyming on that same historical pattern here. And I think what we've seen in the headlines, just the they're there. If you see the signposts, the Republican ticket taking a very friendly and adoptive approach towards Bitcoin and the domestic U.S. financial system. You know what we've seen this week on the custody front within the banking system. You can see where the pieces are moving, and then if you put it in the larger macro backdrop, you know, everything going on in China, et cetera, where we see these big picture macro trends playing out. I don't have to advocate too strongly that, you know, Bitcoin is something to be taken seriously. And at the bare minimum, let's just take the House of Stuarts approach in the 1690s to 1720s. Let's put a lot of irons in the fire. Let's not live by royal decree. Let's also not show favoritism towards one approach or the other. And over time, let's see what wins out. And that's going to put our society, our own domestic finances, our own house in the best position to have a really strong American century over, you know, the coming 100, you know, type of year outlook. I'll end on that. I think that's a positive note.
Wonderful. And we're having Caitlin Long on here in a few weeks to discuss what she's doing with her bank, and maybe we'll get her takes on what the Senate did this week with regard to Bank of New York. Matt Dines, thank you so much for joining us once again here at the Bitcoin Layer. We'll catch you guys next time.
Thank you.